Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Stephanie Hitt, Georgia Logothides, and Charlie Kirk. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. Well, this afternoon, a German newspaper is reporting that President Obama was aware of the spying on the German prime minister. And according to a unnamed National Security Agency official who's speaking on condition of anonymity, basically said to the Economic Times that not only did Obama not stop the operation, but he also ordered it to continue. So this is a further embarrassment, because when the story first broke earlier in the week, the president, through his spokespeople, said that he was not aware of the program and was startled when he learned about it. But again, this comes on the heels, this report comes on the heels of tens of thousands of people who were in Washington yesterday, who were complaining about and wanting complete changes in the NSA as this scandal continues to grow. And one of the speakers yesterday, or one of the signs that was in that crowd, and there were hundreds of signs, it said, "This isn't about right or left, it's about right or wrong." And I want to spend some time tonight talking about the NSA, the impact not only of the expansion and listening in on foreign leaders, which has created an embarrassment all over the world, primarily to our friends, but also what does it mean for that issue in the United States. Georgia Logothides joins us. Georgia, nice to have you back. Georgia,
thank you.
Is one of the key cogs in the Daily Cost, has been for almost 9 years now. Mm-hmm. So you were one of our left of center guests.
Yes.
Do you agree that this is one of these issues that it doesn't have a clear left-right line?
It is an interesting issue, because you see, obviously, on the left, privacy advocates standing up and saying that this is clearly something that shouldn't be tolerated in American society, that we have certain guarantees under the Constitution, and that those need to extend into modern times, into cell phone records, into emails, and everything like that. And on the right side of the spectrum, you have libertarians, you have other privacy advocates as well, who don't believe, just as a fundamental matter, that the government has any business in monitoring people's private lives.
Stephanie Hitt also joins us. Stephanie, nice to have you with us, a graduate of the University of Virginia. Your reaction to this speech, and do you agree, or this issue, and do you agree that this is really not a left-right issue?
Oh, I do. I do agree that it doesn't. You know, it's an issue that doesn't have partisan lines. George is right that, you know, the libertarian component of the Republican Party does, in fact, stand for this, you know, against the invasion of privacy that's here. I think what we are going to see that does come down to a right-left issue is the leadership in this issue and general tendencies of either party in terms of how we manage our foreign relations and our foreign affairs. And when these things pop up, the importance they have.
Philip Beverly, at this rally yesterday, you had representatives from the ACLU, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Council on American Islamic Foundations, the Koch Brothers Freedom Works, Occupy Wall Street. This was a strange gathering of political bedfellows, but they were all there singing the same tune.
This is about Americans being very concerned about a real perceived invasion of privacy. Now, I don't know what has been collected. When you say cell phone records have been collected, is that the actual conversation, the verbatim conversation of millions of people every day? Or is that metadata of where people were, what towers were being pinged when they were having the conversations, sort of movements, different kinds of data? When you talk about the NSA, the reputation is such that they can listen to anything. And so naturally, I think we default into, oh, they must be listening to me.
Charlie Kirk also joins us. He is the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA. You're just back from Europe.
Yes.
And this was a big story in Europe.
Yeah. Thank you for making me go on an assignment, by the way, to Europe.
Yes, thank you very much.
We'll wait
for that expense account to come in.
Yeah, exactly. I went to Madrid, Spain, and they had protests going on in the streets talking about the international sovereignty. Of course, it was lots of younger type people saying, stop spying on my record, stop spying on my life. And it was really interesting to see in Europe the outrage, because I think they look at America, obviously, as, lack of a better term, the leader of the world. But when they're spying on them and spying on them consistently, especially their leaders, I think there's a lot of interesting friction
created.
Were
you there before the story about the German prime minister broke?
It was interesting. I was there a day before and then after, so during the week.
Okay, so
I got to see it escalate throughout the week. And especially in the newspapers, all throughout, I mean, these people were really, really troubled by the fact that everything that they were doing were seemingly being monitored, which was really interesting.
Georgia, again, let's talk about the international aspect of this. Again, there's now the revelation that the United States was spying on friends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we expect to spy on enemies, but spying on friends, that can really ruin a reputation.
I think that for a lot of these governments in Europe, they're already in kind of a very sensitive state, so to speak. You talk about protests in Europe. Europeans love to protest. It's something that we don't really, you know, see here on a daily basis. In Europe, there is that type of ethic where they do take to the streets to express their feelings with respect to, you know, the events of the day. So seeing those types of protests is actually, you know, kind of part and parcel of European democracy.
Are those protests in Europe, are those left of center and right of center as well?
I think what you're seeing in Europe, there's been a very interesting shift in Europe, especially because of these austerity policies that have kind of gone from one end of Europe to the other, especially obviously in southeastern Europe. You see this kind of, you know, merging of interests that you see here in America, where you have leftist politicians standing up against austerity measures. And then the people on the right, however, are also viewing, let's say, the more moderate right in Europe, mm-hmm. are seeing the adverse effects of austerity, which is a rise of extremism. Mm-hmm. You know, so you do see this merging of interests, them trying to stand up a common front against the policy they think is not working for Europe. With respect, though, to the spying that you're talking about, you are seeing, again, on both sides of the spectrum. And it's not an anti-Americanism. People in Europe love Barack Obama. It's not any type of prejudice against the United States or disinterest in national security.
Well, do they? But will the Germans love Barack Obama when if this story is correct? Then again, this is an unnamed National Security Agency official talking to a German newspaper, saying that not only did the operation not stop, but he also ordered it to continue. So here you have Barack Obama basically saying, I want to keep listening in on Chancellor Merkel's phone conversations. That's got to make him less popular in Germany, I would think. Stephanie?
Well, yeah, and I think here's part of the problem, and maybe I'm jumping up to the, you know, the more partisan picture here. But we do know that, many of our relationships with European leaders have been cooling recently. And so I think there's a really important question that has to be asked. I think we can all say that ever since spying began, allies have spied on each other. People know that. And yet it's never, ever escalated to the point of allies being angry with each other. And so I think the problem here is that there are many who feel that had we a better relationship with some of our leaders.
1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking about the NSA scandal and whether or not there's likely to be any changes. You have Democratic U.S. Senator Pat Leahy. You have Republican House leader or major committee chair Sensenbrenner, both a Republican and a Democrat, both saying there's got to be some changes here. Back to this bipartisan feel that something has got to change. But let me put it in context for you, Philip. Maybe you can sort of start this line of questioning. It seems to me that the average American who may be upset about this, they also realize that there is a role for intelligence to play. Where do you draw the line? How do you say that to the average American who says, you know, I don't care whether they're listening in on my phone conversation because I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not saying anything that anything's wrong. So why should people be so upset if someone's phone gets listened in on?
I think it's a little bit more subtle than that. We know that spying goes on all the time. We spy on our friends. We always have. They spy on us. The secret part of that is don't get caught doing it. That's the embarrassment. Don't be so bad at it that it comes out that you were doing what everybody knew you were doing. That's the first part. The second part, I think...
So Chancellor Merkel should not be surprised. Nor should we be surprised that any other intelligence agency in the world is listening in on Barack Obama.
Not at all. And the unfortunately, the power differential here is we have a superior technology to be able to do the surveillance that we do. A lot of countries, I don't want to sound petty about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound petty about it, but if this was El Salvador, would we care? Yeah. They can't really spy on us.
Charlie?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, but I think it's deeper than that. It is that we got caught, but we need to ask ourselves, are we respecting the Fourth Amendment? I think it is unreasonable search and seizure. I think we do have some rights as Americans to our privacy, to our home, to our house. And I think for my generation especially, it's very interesting because we view our email and our Facebook and our Twitter account, that's our personal effects. And right. The older generation, they might not be able to relate that, but you know, you may be more than others. But we think of our email account and our phone, that's a personal piece of property. And
how would you react to those that are saying, wait a minute, your generation, because of Facebook, because of Twitter, you tell everybody everything.
You're giving a status update every 15 minutes.
Why would you worry about privacy? You're breaking the law. You're breaking the law.
Right. And as someone who's sort of on the cusp of these generations, we'll put it that way, that, you know, I am often surprised, and this comes up often, is that people claim this outrage when, you know, parents find out what they put on Facebook or whatever. And the point is that you may feel it's private, but we all know, and we've known this since the telephone was invented. When the telephone was invented, the operator listened into every single phone call. I think that the expectation when you're using these airwaves or what so on, that there isn't that same sense of privacy the way maybe a letter would have your diary.
I think that the main thing to remember in this conversation is that as the technology gets more expansive, as it becomes easier through the technology to have these types of correspondence, whether it's through text or emails or anything like that, then there needs to be a corresponding expansion of privacy protections as well. The law has to catch up to the technology, not just with respect to the NSA, which there's a lot of people that are pushing for a new kind of bill of rights or almost
a digital
bill of rights, a protection act, which I think needs to be done. Because no one's saying that this shouldn't be done. It's in the interest of national security that there is some type of intelligence gathering operation.
Right.
The question is, what measures now is Congress going to take to ensure that there's checks and balances, accountability in the actual program, and most importantly, a measure of redress for citizens that feel that they have been wronged?
Charlie?
I just wanted to bounce off one thing with the Facebook and the Twitter. It's interesting, and I talk to a lot of young people, and I use that same counter argument, but they believe that until you push post, tweet, or send, there's that act of, I'm going to sign away it. Before that, they believe it to be private in their own property. So there are messages in Facebook where if I message somebody privately, if you know Facebook well, that should be a private message, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. If I post something publicly, that should be public. So I think that there is that interesting line that has, of course, been blurred by the recent debate.
But also insofar as just the basic operation is that, you know, I mean, your credit card information. Mm. Yeah. If the government never listened in on my phone conversation, they would know an awful lot about me by looking at my credit card information.
Right.
And that is information that's got to be readily available. But some companies even sell that information.
They do indeed. And I think the element that's been lost in the entire conversation, and the White House has to bear a significant portion of the responsibility because the NSA director works for the president.
Right.
But I haven't heard the same level of interrogation of the Congress in their oversight role. Yeah. where have they fallen down in both houses in oversight of the intelligence community more broadly? And so when that conversation happens, I'd be interested to see what the fuller picture looks like.
Well, congressional oversight has never been what it should be. When you go back to the Church Committee hearings and the revelations about government spying, going back to Seymour Hersh's revelations in 1975, at the core of that was not only did you have an administration that was doing things it shouldn't have done, but you had members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, that were looking the other way because they didn't want to know. They didn't want to know all the things that were going on, and some of the things that were going on, including assassination attempts of foreign leaders and destabilizing governments, and the CIA getting in bed with the mob to knock off Castro. These were devastating revelations. That came out of that.
I think the issue that we've seen over the last several years is that where congressional leaders have been briefed, and specifically the leadership in the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, they have been unable to disclose the existence of programs or the briefings because they are national security briefings. And they would be in violation of the law if they were to come out and say, there's this massive spying program.
Well, you also have the lie that was given by the NSA director or National Security director when he was specifically asked the question by Senator Wyden. Well, does the government have this ability? And he looked and said, no. I mean, he just out and out lied. By the way, in this particular case, as it relates to the phone conversations of a German Chancellor Merkel. Which, again, this German newspaper is now saying they have sources that said that the president was aware of it. This flies in the face of a report earlier this week in the New York Times. Susan Rice, the president's national security advisor, insisted that Obama did not know about the monitoring of Merkel's phone conversations. That's what she said. So here we are. Here's Susan Rice again.
They bring her out.
She's out there. Yeah. They bring her out there whenever there has to be a big lie told, it seems to me.
Right. Well, and I think that's part of, people are having uncomfortable on the right, people are uncomfortable not so much because there is spying, because there's information. I think a lot of Americans will agree, I think discussed earlier, that we need to spy. Intelligence is an important thing. We need to gather these things. They help us. They help us against our enemies. We can help our friends with this information.
Are you talking about spying on friends too?
Yes, I think that you'd be a newborn to not realize that we have spied on our friends. Our friends have spied on us.
I think there's a major distinction between spying on our friends and doing what is alleged over here, which is listening in on the conversations of world leaders.
Right. Well, a personal cell phone. I would agree. There's a
in the intelligence community, the Americans have become enamored with the technology. We've got, KH-11 satellites that can read a license plate at 23,000 miles, and we've got listening devices and all that. And the place that we break down is often in human intelligence because we cannot get to intention. This is a way that you get to intention by listening to what the principal is saying. And so we have to do that.
But I think Bruce brought up a good point earlier about what if this was happening in the United States? What would our reaction be, for example, if we found out that one of our European allies had access to Barack Obama's BlackBerry?
And how do we know they don't?
Exactly. Well, there's one thing I want to point, and that's we talk about the use of it, but what's to say it can't be abused eventually, which I think is a real important function of the Bill of Rights, to prevent government from getting power that eventually can be abusive. And I think they can listen to all of our phone conversations and monitor everything. If there's an abusive function of that, which we've seen abuse of power many times over the last
year. With technology, wherever you have the ability, you're going to try it.
There's
going to
be potential for abuse.
There's going to be someone that's going to say, you know what? Did you know we could listen in on this? Just the two of us. Let's do this.
And that's what the Fourth Amendment is
supposed to be for. Well, and the question comes down to the use of that information as well. I think if we let's change the example a little bit. What if we found out that we were listening into the private phone conversations of John Boehner, and then there would be I think, a very strong outrage in this country. Obviously, the technology would exist to do that. So the question is, what's the use of that information? And there's a real concern of, is this information that's being used for genuine intelligence reason, or is it being used for political reasons? Is it being used for something other than raw intelligence?
And so I would go out a little bit further. And I would say especially to my friends on the right who have accused this president of being very leftist, I think he's governed much more from the center than what he believes and has sort of reconciled that. But what if this were much more an internal battle? If he's this leftist that you proclaim him to be, what better way than to let the NSA sort of spiral out of control and then almost be forced to rein them back in? If he wanted to rein them in, knowing what the abuses were, he'd be opposed by it by your side just for bringing it up. Oh, you're
good
trying
point.
To cripple us.
Oh, good point. And we're going to follow up on that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We now get to that part of our broadcast where we let each of our guests take 15 seconds to share with the audience who they are and why they're here. Georgia Logothetis.
Hi, Bruce. I'm Georgia Logothetis. I am a contributing editor at DailyCoast.com. It's a liberal, progressive community. It's one of the most popular on the internet. So if you're interested in progressive politics, you can check us out at DailyCoast.com.
You've been with them for a long time.
Been with them for a very long time, since 2004. So it's been quite a lot of ups and downs over that course of time. I'm also managing director of the Hellenic American Leadership Council. It's a 501c3 advocacy nonprofit that focuses on foreign policy issues in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Also, Stephanie Hitt joins us. Stephanie, one of our Republicans.
Yes, I'm a political activist, and I live in the fondly termed People's Republic of Evanston, Illinois. As one of the lone Republican voices, I was a delegate in 2008 to the Republican National Convention. And in between driving my four kids around from activity to activity, I get involved. I have the occasion to write occasional pieces for the Washington Times and the American Thinker. And I founded the Evanston Republican Library Lecture Series.
Very good. Philip Beverly joins us.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you. I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University. Have been there for 22 years now. Probably my big contribution there, beside teaching, is I'm one of the administrators and contributors to the faculty blog.
Very good. And Charlie Kirk.
I'm Charlie Kirk, founder and executive director of Turning Point USA. I just turned 20 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yay.
I started this organization about a year and a half ago to give my generation a voice. I'm a fearless defender of free markets and capitalism. I love economics, and I'm giving my generation a chance to fight for their future through an organized structure. And you can check out our website at turningpointusa.net.
Very good. And before we go to our calls, let me just remind everybody that coming up in a couple of weeks, Saturday, November 9th, the 2013 National Radio Hall of Fame will take place here, along with Larry King will be hosting the broadcast. And again, Reba McEntire will be one of our special guests. If you'd like to attend, you can go to our website, museum.tv. All the leaders of radio will be here. We hope that you will join us as well. And also, a couple of weeks later, actually a week later, on November 16th, if you are a fan of the show Mystery Science Theater 3000, there will be the 25th anniversary reunion of that show. All of the original, or many of the original participants that put that great show together, they will be here live in person on Saturday, November 16th. It starts at noon, from noon to 2. Tickets are only $12. You can buy them online at museum.tv. And I saw a glimmer of excitement when I mentioned that. Philip, yeah.
MST 3000.
Yes, I hope my husband's listening. I know
right.
He's going to
well,
be.
Come on
yeah.
down. We've got. In fact, there's been. It's the best advance we've had for any event we've ever done. We've already got close to 175 people coming. So it's going to be a big night, or big day, I should say. And again, $12. Museum.tv, Mystery Science Theater 3000. It is a hip cult show. Still is after all these years. Right. After 25 yeah. years. Let's go to Mary, listening to us on WLS. Tonight, go ahead. You're on our flagship Coast to Coast, Mary.
Hi to you and your guests. I read that the U.S. spied on world leaders during, I believe, the 2010 G8 summit, and I would like to know if you do remember that, if Germany was represented at that summit. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, Germany is always represented at the G8 summit, so
yeah.
I'm sure that they were listening to them as well. Let's go to David listening to us in Evanston on WLS. Go ahead, David.
Hello?
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Bruce.
Speak up a little bit louder. I can barely hear you. We got to crank
up
the sound.
Sorry about that. Hey, I wanted to say I don't understand how anybody cannot look at this economy and say that we're in absolute shambles because of Obamacare. This thing is destroying small businesses. It's destroying security in this country, economic security. And I don't know anybody that has been exposed to it so far that likes what they see. And I'm a small business owner, and this is destroying America. And I just don't see how that we can go forward from here.
Well, let me just interrupt you for a moment. We've gone almost 40 minutes into the show without talking about Obamacare, but you brought it up.
Here we go.
We're going to spend at least we'll go around the table one time to sort of give the summary, because the controversy of Obamacare, I predict, will still be with us next Sunday night. But we'll start with you, Charlie. I know you're not a fan,
yeah.
But how devastating is Obamacare to your generation and the future of the republic?
Extremely. But I'll add a new twist that I probably haven't heard. I'll say that
they're saying in Madrid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they have socialized medicine over there. But I'll just say the Democrats 2 weeks ago, they now own it. It's theirs. This is their bill. The Republicans, interestingly enough, have distanced themselves from this bill. Let them own it. Let them go down with it, because nobody likes this thing, and politically they're going to suffer from it.
Philip Beverly, do you agree with that, that this is now clearly owned and operated by the Democrats?
Are you
going to be proud of that in a year or two from now?
I think it always was, and I think even 2 years from now will be not enough time to determine. I think it's really interesting for the party that always speaks of states' rights. They now want the Fed to run the exchange for their state because they don't want to opt into it. I think that's very curious.
Stephanie, your reaction?
I think what we're seeing is just the beginning, and it's going to be proven that it was flawed at its inception, and it will continue to be flawed through its implementation.
And the problem with the technical problems with the website was just a gift from heaven for Republicans.
It's what it is just, I think, the tip of the iceberg. I think that the real problems are really at its principles and its roots, not just the technical veneer.
Georgia.
Heaven forbid people have affordable health care, huh? I mean, what we've seen in these last few weeks, the people that have been able to log online and see and compare these plans, is that you have Republicans now being written up in local papers across the country that say, I hated Obamacare. I thought it was horrible. And then I signed up for a plan that's saving me hundreds of dollars a month. Interesting, when you look at the polling, when people hear Obamacare, right, they think that it's not this, you know, that it's destroying America and that it's horrible. When they hear the Affordable Care Act, which is what the bill is actually called, they're vastly in favor of it. This is the first time that we've seen polling now in favor of Obamacare or the American of the Affordable Care Act. Okay, and I think, yes, Democrats own it proudly. They may not own the glitches. I'll tell you that. The glitches are something that's inexcusable.
They were bipartisan.
but as we go on, I think, as the program goes through its growing pains, more and more people are not going to have to choose between their medications or food on the table.
Charlie?
I'll say that's a very, you know, bold. You guys are doubling down even further on this thing. I mean, wait until the 15,000 new IRS agents start knocking on small businessmen's doors. Wait until all these business people can't hire more than 50 employees. Wait until you see these states go bankrupt because of the Medicaid expansion. I mean, I'm glad the left is going to own this thing, because politically, we're going to do very well because of it.
And, you know, we just spoke for 40 minutes about the outrage of governments having lots of access to lots of personal information on our cell phones.
Exactly.
Well, we're voluntarily turning over the most personal and most private data willingly to a government organization that is proving that it's really not capable of managing it very well. If it's not through HHS, it's through NSA. So why would Americans want to sign up for more of that?
Let's go to Tom listening to us in Youngstown, Ohio. Go ahead. You're on the air, Tom.
Yeah, Bruce. As far as the NSA is concerned, I think the real question here is the possibility of extreme abuse in a democracy. I mean, you only have to go back to J. Edgar Hoover on the files, all the files he had on all the politicians, and Lyndon Johnson made him FBI director for life, probably because of it. You only have to go back to Watergate and the abuses there, and even for that matter, Barack Obama and the possible abuse of the IRS use against the Tea Party. Could you imagine a campaign situation where they have all the inside information on the opposing party, whether it's Democrats in power or Republicans in power? That could certainly, and they wouldn't have to use it all. They could use it systematically just to get enough seats to be able to sway the House or sway the Senate to their way of thinking.
Well, I think you also go back to the very first interview that Edwin Snowden gave to The Guardian. And again, it was pretty much buried in the article, but it was attributed to him. And he said that it was the goal of the NSA that they wanted to understand the behavioral attitudes, the behavioral aspect of Americans. Yeah. And so when you want to get into someone's behavior, that's a lot deeper than just getting into their head and figuring out what their politics are. This is, where do they go on vacation? Who do they go with? Who do they sleep with? What websites do they go to? I mean, this is getting into about as invasive involvement into the lives of the American people. And you're correct. I mean, people have been using that type of intelligence to blackmail, to control, to intimidate political leaders since long before any technology was developed. So now with the new technology to have that capability, and again, we go back, as you alluded to J. Edgar Hoover, I mean, his legendary use and abuse of intelligence, they've been written, volumes have been written on that. But, just think about what he could have done had he had the access to some of the new technologies that we have.
And I think it's interesting that in the corporate sector, if I was a CEO of a large corporation, I'd want to know exactly what the NSA wants to know about the behavior of the American consumer.
Right.
And so if I'm in the private sector, I can't afford to do the thing that the NSA does. So why not have the NSA do it?
But you
and then
can,
when it
but
becomes
you
released,
well, the corporations
but you can
do
to some
do
extent,
it, though. Yeah.
You can to some extent. When,
but
when,
not at
when,
the scale that they
well,
can.
But, if I go on and a Google ad pops up and it's they know what site I've gone to. And if I've looked up, flights to California, and suddenly the next time I go on, they're popping up something here, come to San Diego. I mean, they're using that technology. They're using information that I have shared with them, and they're using it for commercial purposes. What I'm saying is, if you're using it for commercial purposes, you can use it for nefarious purposes, and that's the great fear. And I think that that's real legitimate, which is one of the concerns why we keep talking about this important issue. It's not going away, and I think it is one of the most important issues in the country today. Back short. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We've got a segment left in this hour of the broadcast, and I do want to spend some time talking about Saudi Arabia and their sort of thawing of relations with the United States. Is that too strong a word, Georgia? I mean, how important is this relationship? And most importantly, how important is the sort of the rhetoric of the last week suggesting that they want to back away from us because of the perceived weakness and inaction of the Obama administration in Syria and in Iran?
Our relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important relationship. Any relationship that we have, both with Saudi Arabia and other, kind of quote-unquote more moderate governments like Turkey's government, they are important relationships. And I think what the United States has learned over the last several years, especially with the Arab Spring and the Gezi Park protests, is that with your allies, you can't only just ask them, for favors, right?
Right.
There needs to be responsibilities on their part as well. And I think with Saudi Arabia, what's happened is because they've been for so long a strategic partner in the region, we've let a lot of other things slide, especially on the human rights front. And that obviously has put certain tensions on the relationship now that within Saudi Arabia, there's more of an internal effort for, pressing for those types of human rights. Same thing going on in Turkey as well.
But Stephanie, do you think that this really is just another, glaring and blaring, spotlight that the Obama administration is really messing up foreign policy and our reputation around the world?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a spotlight, but I think it's along the continuum of the ideology that Barack Obama entered the presidency with this aloofness, this sense of you know, we're not going to direct our allies, we're not going to, you know, take a lead, and so as a result, this distancing that he's done in the Middle East, this is what we're getting out of it. And I don't think that Saudi Arabia is leaving our side completely, but they are clearly demonstrating that there is not a trust of the U.S. anymore. We're not a reliable ally.
Do you agree with that, Philip, not reliable?
No, I'm more curious about what the internal dynamics are in Saudi right now. I mean, the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi.
Right.
So it's not that every Saudi citizen is going to be allied with us. And the ruling family has to understand what the level of discontent within their country is. And as a fairly closed country, it may be something that Americans don't understand, that they're still running gun battles in some Saudi cities with Al-Qaeda.
So they have
operatives.
To take a swipe at us. Distance themselves from us to protect their own home base.
Absolutely.
Charlie?
Yeah, I think there's a valid point to that, but I don't think this is going to escalate very far. I mean, when it comes down to it, Saudi Arabia's biggest backbone of their economic is oil. And who buys a lot of their oil? It's the United States. And there's a huge trade implication there. When it really comes down to it, Saudi Arabia is not going to sacrifice 35% of their net exports overnight because of some – and it will hurt us as well. Don't get me wrong. Right. But I think there's a huge economic
I want to just really quickly go back to the point that you had raised about the ideology coming into the office of a kind of hands-off foreign policy. I think that when you look at all of the different crises that have happened, it obviously is not a hands-off foreign policy. It's a different type of foreign policy that we experienced under the Bush years. So under the Bush years, obviously, it was very interventionist. It was very much America is a big bear in the Middle East, whether you like it or not. Okay, and now we are viewing the repercussions of that in terms of America standing abroad. When Barack Obama came into office and he made that speech in the Middle East, right? And he the Cairo speech. The type of response that you saw in papers across the Middle East was amazing. And the question now is, what does he do going forward? He can't be
What would those papers be saying about him now? Would they be saying that he is weak because of what happened in Syria? Would they say that the position of leaders leading from behind? What would they say? I mean, they were cheering him. They loved the speech. But what are they saying now?
Well, or that he's representing American interests the way that every president is going to represent American interests. As much as he may be personally opposed to drone strikes killing Taliban or Al-Qaeda, you know, folks in Pakistan and Afghanistan, he's still going to do it. Yeah. He's still going to implement that particular strategy, right?
Real quick, whatever bad, you know, kind of take they have on Barack Obama now, it would be much, much worse if he were to unilaterally go in and try to dictate Middle Eastern policy to these governments.
Yep. But the problem is, and I think this is something where, you know, America's is never and Americans don't always grasp, is in the Middle East, strength is very important. Like, you know, likability, collegiality, it works better in Europe. It doesn't necessarily work in the Middle East. And so he went in there saying, I want to be liked. I know we no longer have to be feared. And I think the problem, the misstep is that we still need to be feared in the Middle East.
Charlie? Yes and no. I think that, you know, if we bomb Iraq, we got a lot of negative repercussions, antagonism from the region. I think that's still there. I think, though, that a really interesting way to go about this would to be lifting a lot of sanctions with Middle Eastern countries. I mean, there's no other way that people hate us more because we're not allowed to buy our goods, we're not allowed to buy theirs. I think with Iran, we've crippled their economy, and I think they are an enemy to the state, but there's no reason why we should just put all these sanctions and barriers of trade. Trade's a great way that promotes peace. If you're trading with a country,
you think
less likely.
We should loosen those sanctions?
Yeah, I think that we should loosen sanctions and expand free trade. I think that's a great way to establish peace and prosperity for both sides.
It works in China.
Yeah. I mean, we're less likely to go to a war with a country if you're buying stuff from them.
On that note, we want to thank those who are left of center. We want to thank Georgia Logothetes from The Daily Cause. We want to thank Philip Beverly from Chicago State University. And on the right side, we want to thank Stephanie Hitt from the People's Republic of Evanston, and Charlie Cook from Turning Point USA. They have all been with us in the first hour of our broadcast. They were so scintillating. They will all be back for the next hour, and we're going to go into a variety of different directions politically, so we hope that you'll keep those calls coming at 1-800-723-8289. That's for the people who are listening on radio. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Stephanie Hitt, Georgia Logothites, and Charlie Kirk. Our program tonight, Comedy from Our Own Base on State Street, that great street, the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Nice to have you with us. Our toll-free line's open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv, or join us on the web, beyondthebeltway.com. And tonight, in the next hour, we're going to be talking about sort of broad political discussions and finding out where everybody's political, where they cut their political eye teeth, and also pet topics that they bring to the table this week on our broadcast. Philip Beverly joins us. Philip is a associate professor of politics, has for many years at Chicago State University. Your interest in politics, was it a campaign? Was it a candidate? What turned you on to politics?
10 years old and then 13 years old. Quick story. My dad recorded the Watergate hearings, and I remember listening to Senator Sam Ervin in those hearings and thinking, wow, this is exciting. What a politics nerd. And then I remember after the Republican primaries in 1976, my dad said, Ronald Reagan's going to be the president in 1980.
Ah, your father, was he a political scientist?
He's a history teacher.
Okay, good. Well, a very, very smart man. Stephanie Hitt, first inkling that politics was going to be part of your life.
Well, I would say where I first got engrossed with the dynamic of politics was watching confirmation hearings, or the attempt to nominate, I'm sorry, the nomination hearings for Robert Bork for the Supreme Court, and watching that dynamic with Ted Kennedy and how it all became all political. And that's where I think it dawned on me that politics is bigger than
televised congressional investigations. Very good. All right, let's go to Georgia Logothites, one of our left of center guests.
Yeah, well, I've been told that when I was very, very little, I wanted to run for president and had calculated the days and tried to bribe people with candy. But what I actually remember is in the 2004 election, right after the election, I stumbled across – I was very upset, and I had stumbled across this hideous orange site called Daily Kos. And I was amazed that there were people out there that kind of felt the same way that I did. And I started writing about the news that was coming out of Ohio in terms of the allocation of voting machines to kind of promote voter suppression. And I ended up researching that intensively and putting together like 30 pages of research on it. And ever since then, I've been hooked.
But nothing really as a real young person. I mean, you were young, but not like it wasn't like an 8 or 10 year old experience.
No. This was, you know, in 2004.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Charlie Kirk, you're 20 years old. So It probably wasn't long ago, but what was the moment?
I was in sixth grade, and it was a teacher I really didn't like, and she was a science teacher, and she, for an entire period, said how bad President Bush was. Now, I wasn't necessarily a fan of President Bush, but I just didn't like this teacher. So I researched almost all night all these great stuff about President Bush in sixth grade. I came back to the next class. I debate her for the entire class, and I realized I love this stuff. I love debating. I love politics. I love civics. So I just – my parents were Republicans, so I researched it more, and from ever since, I was the proud Republican in the class, and I just absolutely fell in love with it.
And Stephanie, right now, what is the issue that is out there? What is the issue that turns you on the most or riles you up or –
The thing that gets me, and I go through these periods where I'm like, oh, just forget it all and just go live your life. Why do I care? But I think there's the thing that gets me is, I think we may all agree, many Americans feel very disconnected and very disassociated with what does go on in politics, and that there isn't, you know, people get tired of it. They have maybe a superficial understanding of it or whatever. And we don't really grasp, many Americans don't want to grasp, they don't have the luxury to grasp it, of what goes on in Washington in that bubble.
But what is the issue? Politics, again, is about solving particular issues. What is the issue? I mean, is it foreign policy? Is it domestic policy? Is it women's issues? What is it? What's the issue that concerns you the most? If you could wake up tomorrow and wave a magic wand, what would you want to see happen or change?
What I would like to see is the return to what we call American exceptionalism, and the fact that the bigger our government grows, the more that we want to dumb down things in our society, the more we're going to take away from what makes.
Such as.
Education is a perfect example. The way that the federal government wants to get involved, control, start taking over education. You know, I have four kids. I care very much. I've always been a believer that the best things that happen, even with the involvement of government, tend to be on the most local of levels.
Do you agree with that, Georgia?
I think that we should be focusing on investing in education, because every single study shows for every single dollar invested in education, and yes, those are usually federal dollars, society saves something like $7 down the road in terms of incarceration costs, entitlement costs and everything like that. So when we talk about the federal government stepping away from the education process, I think that's absolutely the wrong way to go. The federal government should be investing more in education if we're going to be helping out families and states generally
with
their funding issues.
I disagree. I think that, you know, something as personal as education should come down to the family. And does a federal bureaucrat know what's better for you and your family for education choice? No, like you said, on an educational local level, if you're able to come together as a community or as a family and dictate how you want to educate your kids, look, people in Illinois are going to be learning different things than in Florida or Texas or Oregon. Something as personal and essential as education
there basic things? We're going back to core teaching now, which is a controversial thing within the education. Right. Shouldn't there be some basic things that are taught in all 50 states that people could agree on?
I would think that if you let the states go with natural functions, you're going to see a lot of similarities and parallels that are going to naturally come up. The problem is if you start dictating curriculum, there's almost no stop to it. And then you see federal bureaucrats going on right now in Common Core that come into these school districts saying, here are your reading lists, here what you have to do. And it gets very scary, and then it starts going in a way.
Why is it scary that a student in North Dakota should not know the same thing that a student in Mississippi or Illinois
knows? Right, I think ideally,
and I don't mean the entire curriculum, but I mean some basic stuff about, you know, about U.S. history, things that we might agree on.
But the problem is that the things that are being dictated through things like Common Core or standardized testing are very minimal standards. And for those schools and those, you know, charter schools or whatever that want to do more, they're running up against the bureaucracies. They're running up against the unions. They're running up against incredible resistance from a very organized level to make things better.
Philip Beverly?
I agree completely with you about American exceptionalism. And why is it that we are so low in the world rankings? Part of it is because we have this very diffused educational system and process. In China, they have a bureaucracy that dictates what their sort of curriculum is going to be for a country that is significantly larger than ours. and it seems to be working in some capacity.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we'll hear more from our guests and hopefully your calls. 1-800-723-8029. Coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night, taking America's political pulse. Chicago, thank you very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029. Next segment, we're going to turn to Philip Beverly. Philip, of all the issues that are out there, and you've been on this program talking about many of them, what's the one, if we were to make you the czar to deal with that issue, what would that issue be?
Oh, wow. I would have to say that it's about our level of civic engagement. And how do we get more Americans involved beyond the 10 minutes they may spend in a polling place every couple of years? The students that I tend to teach, just their physical affect when they come into a political science class is like, oh, my God, you're going to torture me. Politics is dirty. It's corrupt. They don't listen. My vote doesn't count. It doesn't matter. It's all about money, and the powerful are going to get what they want. And the disconnection is so profound. And so I spend most of my time just trying to connect the dots of, you won't solve everything, but find that issue that resonates with you on some local level that you can get involved in tackling.
But do but the hopelessness,
it's
there. It's widespread.
It's worse than hopelessness. Yeah. It is a despondency that I don't know how to address.
I deal with this on a daily, every day. I mean, I run a youth organization trying to get people excited about something that a lot of people don't care about, free markets and capitalism, but economics in general. I encourage the debate and even get kids talking about it. It's kind of like they feel like they're in a lecture hall. But we've had a lot of success. But I agree with you. There is a lot of apathy, but it's not just the younger kids. It's a lot of adults, too, that are just apathetic about it. They say, there's no way we can make any difference. Even if I vote, they're going to keep on doing the same thing. I don't even know the difference anymore, and the media is all to one way. It's unfortunate that the apathy is.
I would agree. Well, I feel like that's what I, you know, sort of my thing is. There's so many people that say, "Why should I care?" They feel disaffected. They feel disconnected. It's cross generational. It's cross party lines.
George, I want to just go back to you because again, you were a big supporter of Barack Obama. You were very excited about him. Obviously, he won the Democratic primary against Hillary by running to Hillary's left. And yet, in areas of some military involvement and certainly in some areas of foreign policy and escalating drone strikes and, you know, not being too quick to close Guantanamo and supporting, you know, the NSA programs and you know, criticizing, you know, Snowden and everybody else, Julian Assange. Where do you come down on that issue? Because you are coming from a constituency that I would think would not be real happy with Barack Obama, that he has sort of let much of your constituency down.
I don't think many people were under the illusion that Barack Obama would govern as a liberal. I think that the people that were paying attention to the issues, right, and I'm talking about the informed voters, the activists, the party officials, we knew going in that Barack Obama was not a liberal with a capital L, okay? So he is obviously center-left, and he's been forced because of the Republican interest agents in Congress to govern more towards the center and even center-right on certain issues. So is there disappointment? Absolutely there's disappointment, especially on issues with respect to protecting Social Security and some other aspects where it seems like always an uphill battle to, you know, draw the line in the sand and hold the line, not just against Republican attempts to gut the social safety net, but Democratic attempts as well.
So is that correct then to your students, Philip? Is it correct for you to say, you know what, you could get really excited about a candidate and they can say whatever they want in a primary and in a general election, but you should probably know that whatever they've promised, they're probably not going to be able to deliver on everything and maybe on not a lot of things. And they may change their mind once they get into the seat of power and they get all the reports from all the intelligence and some things that they talk about in a campaign they can't do when they're sitting in the Oval Office. Can you explain that to your students?
And that's exactly what I do. I teach a course, Campaigns and Elections, and so I'm pretty good having run a couple campaigns, and I understand that part and understand that the candidate is going to be different than the person who governs. And separate those two out. listen to the campaign rhetoric, and then understand you're going to have to examine those issues for yourself and figure out if this person is going to do even anything close to what they say. What I say to my students is don't look necessarily for what they may do, but for use almost a harm reduction strategy. Who's going to do the least harm to you?
Is that a way to vote, though, Charlie?
Well, I think we have to look at the track record. And unfortunately, when we President Obama, there really wasn't a governorship track record. Yes, he was in the Senate, but he never governed anything, whereas a state or even a locality. Whereas if presidents in the past, George Bush, Bill Clinton, the other Bush and Reagan, they all governed something, yeah, whether it be an agency or a state. So I think when you're voting, you should be looking at that. But going to your point about with the young people, I think it's very important to make it relevant. Pick issues that they can understand. And, you know, it's interesting, AARP has done this for years with older people. They found issues that matter to older people, like Medicare and Social Security. When you go to a meeting of older people, you're going to talk about that. When you go to a meeting with young people, don't talk about Medicare and Social Security. Talk about student loans or cell phones. There's nothing more relevant than cell phones with young people. So I think that's a very important lesson that we can take away, especially when...
What about legalized drugs?
Well, that's a big one, especially. That polls in the 70 to 80% numbers, especially on the state level.
Absolutely.
And I wouldn't even say legalize. That's a very strong word. Decriminalize can be an even softer word that people on both sides of the aisle can agree with. And that's a big, big issue for people of the younger generation.
Would that be an issue, Philip? Because I know another issue that's near and dear to your heart is the over-criminalization of America.
I agree.
Absolutely.
And it seems,
yeah,
to me that that's an issue where,
absolutely,
young, not necessarily old, but certainly young Republicans, Democrats, the libertarian element of the Republican Party, and certainly the Democrats. I mean, that's where I think, you know, when I look at a candidate that seems to have the ability to maybe reach out to expand the voter base, I look at Rand Paul. I mean, I look at Rand Paul as a candidate who has a intellectual attractiveness to some who are left of center and right of center. Do you agree with that, Georgia? I know you're not going to support Rand Paul, but you understand that he's not your average, typical Republican?
I think that people are desperate for politicians who don't sound like politicians. Mm-hmm. So when somebody comes to the table, whether it's Chris Christie, whether it is a Rand Paul, and they seem like they're cutting through the noise with frankness and with what appears to be authenticity of position, then automatically people's ears perk up. I think you're going to get the young people, though.
Ted Cruz fits into that category? Has he touched a nerve?
Ted Cruz has definitely marched onto the stage and tried to get all the attention. Whether it's a lasting kind of bubble around him, it remains to be seen.
He
has it at
the
moment.
He hasn't maybe touched the nerve of some, you know, of a certain generation. But just as Rand Paul talks in a way that young people can relate, I think Ted Cruz does talk in a way that a lot of people, it resonates with a different generation or a different group, such as conservatives.
Is he doing it with young people?
Well, I'll go back to the Rand Paul example,
yeah, sure,
which I think is really interesting, because, yeah, Ron and Rand Paul have a lot of similarities. Rand, right, is a little bit more moderate than his,
yeah,
father. But I've seen it firsthand. I've gone to universities where liberals, moderates, and conservatives, they go crazy over the message, because I can tell you three reasons why a liberal should like Rand Paul, the first of which, he's been against drone strikes from the very, very beginning. He hasn't been one of those fashionable people. The second of which is his foreign policy has been consistent. And the third of which is...
And the NSA,
yeah, right. And the third of which is Rand Paul has, for a liberal, been very liberal on drug policy. I mean, liberal,
for
lack of a better
term. Republican.
Right, for a Republican.
Yeah.
Right, and those three things, I mean, you're hard-pressed to find Democratic leaders that are as consistent as Rand Paul is on those things.
Right.
So I can make a liberal case for Rand Paul.
Too bad on the domestic policy, though. All his policies would essentially decimate the middle class.
Yeah, his introduction to the African-American community was a bit flawed when he showed up.
You have to see, like, not enough Republicans you can admit go to those kind of...
Of course venues. They don't.
What happened? Explain what
you're
talking about.
He went to a historically black college university, probably the flagship of the HBCUs, and the reports from folks that I've talked to who sort of saw the whole thing talked down to in a very sort of patronizing way. He's not from where these kids are from. He's not
from
that Kentucky place. And so
Texas.
Don't sort of roll in there thinking that you got some answers for
is
them.
There any
you don't.
Is there any Republican other than the late Jack Kemp who could roll in and have that type of conversation?
Chris Christie, I think, could.
Think
I think
Chris
he's a
Christie?
Very down-to-earth person. I mean, I think you can relate to a lot of
what
people.
What about Mark Rubio?
I don't believe that necessarily it comes down to a point of can they. I don't think that they want to. Because I think having the conversation, you're going to find out really how diametrically opposed you are on most things. And unfortunately, the discourse that we have in our country is all about where we don't agree. And we spend so little time trying to figure out where we do agree and building on that.
But does decriminalization of drugs, and he's also raised questions about the over-incarceration of Americans, does that seems to me a subject that could play well in the African American community.
And what is the thing to do about that? I mean, I think it's interesting you mentioned the thing about governance. Rand Paul hasn't governed anything either.
I agree with you.
So he doesn't necessarily make the strongest case for, you know, being somebody selected like that.
The track record's been all legislative, and I would absolutely agree with that.
If I can get really quick back to the original kind of point about engaging the youth. The elephant in the room, of course, is that the majority of Congress is not youthful. Right? It's very hard to relate with a generation that cannot relate back to you on issues like student loan reform. What is it like to have a degree or a master's degree and not be able to find a job for 2 years? And I think the major problem is on both sides of the aisle, that there are not enough young people in their 30s, in their early 40s, that are taking the risk to run for political office and to represent a new generation that has grown up under an entirely different set of circumstances than most of the people in Congress have.
Charlie, are you ready to announce? Are you ready to announce?
But, you know, I think Georgia has a good point, and that's, you know, when we it sort of touches on some of our political revelation moments and other things we're interested in, that is a lot of people are disgruntled with the process of politics. They see it about money. They see it as about connections. They see it about beholden. That's what people see it as. And young people are turned off by that, and they're not old enough to get into it.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Live from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Around the table this evening, Georgia Logothites is with us. She is one of the key cogs in the Daily Cause. She's also with the Hellenic American Leadership Council.
Yes.
And Stephanie Hitt also joins us. She is a mother of four, and she's a graduate of Wellesley. You went to Wellesley, University of Virginia Law School. Is that correct?
Right. Correct.
And also used to work in Rudy Giuliani's office when he was the U.S. attorney in New York and Manhattan. Philip Beverly also joins us for many years, associate professor of political science at Governor's State, Chicago State University. Chicago State University. And Charlie Kirk, he is the founder and the executive director of Turning Point USA, 1-800-723-8029. We've been asking each of our guests to sort of tell us about the things that they want to get off their chest that are most important. So, Charlie, we're going to turn to you for this segment.
Yeah, mine's actually more policy-oriented than the two prior. So people ask why I do what I do, you know, what's my inspiration, and there's a lot of different reasons for it. But actually something that was in the news cycle last week, and that's the ridiculous amount of debt that we're placing on our children's backs and shoulders. This is a bipartisan issue. This should not be Republican or Democrat. But in the past 5 years, in the past 10 years, 15 years, we've seen politicians consistently, and I hate this term, I hate it, kicking the can down the road. It's overused, and people don't even realize what that means. But trillions of dollars of debt are being put in my generation's back to pay for the mistakes of our parents and grandkids. And if you want to talk about morality, you want to talk about fairness, this is a total disservice that we're doing to my generation. And if you go to our website, you'll see the debt clock clicking, tick, tick, tick. Everybody should be thinking about that when these politicians are giving these grandiose speeches.
How do you get the attention not only of your generation but others when you deal with figures that large, and can you make a case? Can you verbally make a case from point A to point B as to what how they can make a difference in stopping this flow of federal spending?
Right, it's so difficult. And one of the things we did, our organization, is we created the first ever student debt clock. Now, not student loan, but student debt clock, calculating each high school graduate's share of the national debt, which is interesting because $17,100,000,000,000, that's a number that nobody can understand.
We'll
never figure that out. But if you boil it down to a number that's their share of the national debt, that's much more like, wow, that's how much I owe. So we did a lot of actuarial analysis, and we figured each student owes over $870,000 to the federal government. I mean, that's ridiculous when you think about it. That's a second mortgage.
Let's talk about people that aren't students, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Do they care? I mean, to a person who is over 21 years old, do they say, hey, my whole life we've kicked the can down the road. Why don't we just keep kicking the can down the road? It's not going to be my problem. It's somebody else's problem. You know what? Nobody worried about that I was inheriting debt. Why should I care?
So there's two different issues going on. First of all is this kind of debt fetish that has been going on in our political debate over the last, you know, 5 to 6, 5 to 7 years, which is an obsession in Washington, D.C. with the debt, which is a problem, but is not this sky is falling type of immediate problem that is going to destroy America tomorrow. Okay? It's not. It's a long-term issue that needs to be addressed in a responsible and adult fashion. And the problem is that it's become very reactionary, where every single other major issue on the table for the Republican Party has been completely subserved to this debt fetish, including job growth, creating more investment in education, addressing the dire need of states to have more funding or to balance their books in a way where they can't do it by themselves because there's not enough money circulating in the states to do so. Whenever you look at the polling, debt does not score more than usually in the single digits,
right,
in terms of what's most important to American families when they sit down at their dinner table. It's jobs, it's education, and it's worrying about what type of America their children will grow up in.
Stephanie?
And that doesn't have anything to do with a debt clock.
Well, the problem is, and I think this is where organizations like Charlie's are really important, and that is connecting that debt liability to what that's going, how that's going to affect your daily life,
okay,
the kinds
of things,
of programs the government's going to be going.
How will
it's going to affect the delivery of health care?
I can
it's
tell
going
you.
To be
so
doing that.
I'll tell you exactly how the debt affects all those things. And for big government liberals, you should be the first ones trying to balance the budget. I'll tell you why. With interest rates the way they are, like 3.8%, when they double, that's going to be a ridiculous amount of money we can't spend on those things. The national share of the federal debt right now is about 17% in interest. It's going to jump to 34% if we don't balance our books. That's money you can't spend on education. That's money you can't spend on Medicare, Medicaid.
But won't those interest rates increase if we were, like, to say, default on?
Oh, of course. Now, I'm not talking about the way that we're handling. I'm talking about the issue. And to say that we're kicking it down and saying it's not pertinent right now, I would disagree with that.
And can we reconcile that maybe it's both? Maybe it is important right now and not as important as some other things right now. And can we hold the tension of that? Because that's sort of where I go, that it's not some either or, which is where the discourse always takes us to.
But, you know, the responsibility of Congress is the budget, is our money. That is their job. So, I mean, I think, you know, they're not just playing games by making this an issue. I think, you know, they do have that responsibility. And the problem is that we do have a government, and under certain administrations, and I'm not, you know, a lot of them take blame for this, is they've been treating it like funny money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not funny money. At the end of the day, we're going to be having higher taxes.
The only time you get any exposure for this issue, Charlie, is every 4 years in a Republican primary. There will be somebody in that Republican primary field who will be on the dais, you know, whether it's Rand Paul or Steve Forbes, Congressman Ron Paul, they would talk about it. But then after that six-month window is over, the rest of the party is not talking about it because other things have come up.
You're right. But I think we have to, and I know you guys will disagree. If it wasn't for the Tea Party, this wouldn't even be discussed at all.
Right.
Now, these debt ceiling debates—
I absolutely disagree with that.
In 2008, 2009, 2010, nobody was talking about how much the stimulus would bankrupt our children's future. The Tea Party won on three key issues: the limited government, free markets, and fiscal responsibility. If it wasn't for these extreme measures, the fiscal responsibility would not be in the public dialogue, and we have to thank them for that, because our children's future are being spent away.
Georgia, do you want to thank the Tea Party?
Absolutely not. Okay, well, let's talk about this in a practical fashion and kind of put aside the political talking points and the nice little catchphrases. The fact is that there is massive debt. How do you propose to deal with it? You have one party that is taking essentially a slash and burn approach, which is, you call it fiscal responsibility, which is a great phrase, but which in implementation is a type of austerity that is ripping Europe apart right now, and we're trying to emulate it over here.
You want me to?
Okay?
I can, yeah.
So that's one aspect of it, practically speaking. The second aspect of it, though, is you can't on the one hand say we need to address the debt, and it's an immediate crisis. And the only way to address the debt, obviously, is to tighten the government's belt. At the same time, though, you have a middle class that is shrinking at an unprecedented rate. You have a whole generation of Americans that are being sunk into poverty because they can't find jobs. And at the time in their lives when they need the government the most, you have a political party that is coming to the table and saying, you know what? Yeah, you may not have enough money to eat this month, but we're going to cut your Social Security or we're going to cut your Medicaid because it's more important that I can go back for my reelection and say that I lowered the debt by a certain, you know, $5 billion.
Right. There's a lot there, and I'll keep it pretty short. But I think that what it comes down to is that the Republicans, they want to make long-term solutions to save, protect, and preserve those programs that you care about. Our children in about 5 years are going to be deficit paying for our grandparents' Medicare because it has not been solvent from the beginning. Social Security is not solvent for another 8 years. And we went back to another thing which you talked about was austerity. What's going on in Europe, it's not austerity. They're raising taxes. That's becoming making the economy less free. There's a lot of – Spain raised taxes by 7% in the last 5 years. Republicans aren't proposing that. They're proposing efficiency programs, cutting spending, and freeing up the economy. That's not what Spain or Europe did. They raised taxes and cut spending arbitrarily. Well,
Philip.
And so the preserve and protect those programs, I'm always a bit dubious about how the rubber meets the road on that.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get the government to stay open for a couple of weeks because of what exactly? I'm still trying to figure out why we had that shut down.
How many people
got an irresponsible Congress that can't decide beyond, oh, why don't we have the sequester do it so we don't have to take responsibility?
Mm-hmm.
Really? That's what it's come down to? We don't want to take responsibility, so we'll have the sequester.
There are a lot of points being made here. First of all, you know, this slash and thing is not what's happening. The way to solve our debt problems is certainly not to expand government entitlements and programs, which is all we've seen in the last 5 years. The other thing, too, that's very important to note is that, you know, that the way that this – the way that this is being addressed, the people are, they're hurting. They're not getting jobs because we are increasing mandates, increasing regulation, increasing taxes, all the things that go in to make up the deficits that this government is incurring.
Except that those deficits have been going down under President Obama. Why don't we admit that
because of a Republican Congress?
They may be
and you know that
because
too.
Of a re-
until the Republican
and it was still
Congress,
that Republican Congress
up.
That took our national debt from $5 trillion to $12 trillion
was,
in 6 years.
Which goes back
that
to my
was
tea par-
the
going
that
back
was
to the Tea Party point. That's a different brand of Republicanism that has been born in 2010. There is a principle
and it was that brand of Republicanism that shut our government down with no substantive solutions.
Let's talk about the government shutdown. What did we lose when that happened? Medicare checks were still going. Social Security checks were still going. I mean, some people.
I understand it was a $24 billion hit to GDP.
You couldn't get to the Washington Monument to look up at that ball.
So what happened is a couple workers got a nice vacation with back pay. Is that really what we lost? What we had a national discussion on fiscal restraint, and our children are going to be drowning in debt, just like Greece, Italy, and Spain is right now, if we do not buckle our belts.
It was less of a discussion and more like a tantrum.
That's right.
I mean,
that's what I got.
There
was more of a tantrum that was about Obamacare, wasn't it?
If the whole purpose of the shutdown was to draw attention to, you know, out of control government spending, that's not what the Tea Party drew attention to. You know what it drew attention to? The fact that the Tea Party came across as cruel and heartless, and it didn't care about the plight of American families.
And what we
have no solution.
We can live without 15% of the government.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. George Ologathides, you get the last segment here. What issue do you want to get off your chest?
Well, I'm hoping it's an issue that everybody can agree on, which is the undue influence of money in politics. Campaign finance reform is an issue that is very near and dear to my heart. Being kind of on the inside and the outside. So I've been part of campaigns that have gone out and begged for those big dollar checks, and I've been on the active.
And been very successful.
And, you know, I've been on campaigns where, you know, I do the digital fundraising and we're trying to raise grassroots funds, and I've been on the outside as an activist trying to push for real campaign finance reform, not this kind of fig leaf measures that are often proposed by politicians who want to claim that they're above the fray with the one hand and then kind of take the max out checks on the other. And I think that we're getting to a point in our politics. First of all, we have to kind of dispense with the idea that money and politics is some type of new you know, disease. It's always been that way. You've always had this exchange of, you know, influence for votes going back since democracy was created, okay? So we have to dispense with the pretense that we can create an absolutely pure and innocent system. Politics is not pure. Politics is not innocent. But the question is, how do we revamp the system such that you don't have this massive influx of money, largely by corporate interests or people who control corporate interests, mm-hmm. that it becomes a completely quid pro quo, essentially legalized bribery situation. And I feel that that's an issue that, you know, we got a little bit of traction on it with Citizens United, but unfortunately both parties benefit from keeping the system broken.
That's why I'm not optimistic that it's going to be repaired, because this is something that both parties know how to play.
Well, and
they can both game the system.
And that's sort of the frustration. I think several of us have talked tonight mm-hmm. about the frustration of people's involvement in politics and the view of politics by people. They think it is about money. And I think, Georgia, you and I completely agree on this. Wouldn't that be great? I have to say, one of the things that I have found most agreement among my Democrat friends or libertarian or whatever is, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow find a way to take the money? I mean, the days of Mr. Smith going to Washington are pretty much over. And so, you know, we look at, you know, some other countries do it differently. Wouldn't it be great if we just said, okay, there's a 6-week campaign period. Everybody gets $500,000.
You don't like it?
All going to be about the issues, debates, talk.
I want long campaigns. Not only do I want them long campaigns, because it gives us a lot to talk about mm-hmm. on the show every week.
It's true.
But I like it because, you know what, in every campaign, I want to see a campaign and a candidate stumble. And I want to see them get up. I want to see them take a punch and how they react to it. If we make it, if we make the road to the White House too short, I think we're going to be getting people that we will regret, and we will learn about how they react after mm-hmm. they're the president of the United States. So I think that's a positive thing. Why our campaign? Now, again, maybe you started maybe 6 months less, but. You know,
but the problem is the longer the campaign, the more money, and the more opportunities for corruption. And, you know, and we do live in an age where the soundbite, the messaging, all of that seems to supersede content.
Absolutely.
And what is lacking at the very least is real, true content, ideas.
They come out during the campaign.
They might be a little sullied, a little from all the dirt around it.
But then they're often overrided by who can spend more on the TV ad. And we all know the TV ads at the last minute before you go to vote, those are big.
A person's ability to rally people to their cause, which is salesmanship, mm-hmm. you get money. You've got to be presenting ideas that people want to support. You have to have a degree of leadership.
Is it things that they want to support or what they're opposing? Because it's negative campaigning, as much as people may hate it, it works, and we do it well.
And what we've learned is good campaigners don't necessarily make good leaders.
That's right.
But that's the process we have.
But we've got to start with the conversation in our culture about money is speech, and so it's all sort of First Amendment protected. And as long as that's sacrosanct, we can't move to any kind of conversation around public financing.
Supreme Court's ruled on that. It's not going to likely change.
A couple points, and I agree with you. It is a problem, but what you're seeing, to agree with you, is companies are actually considering campaign contributions as investments. I give XYZ to a candidate. I mean, GE is a great example. Jeffrey Immelt, I'm going to get you elected, Barack Obama. You keep my corporate income tax rate at 0% and get all these government contracts. There are examples on both sides of the aisle. But I think that the campaign finance is a good issue, but I think it's kind of an after effect and doesn't go to the root. And I think there's two big problems at the root. The first of which is term limits. People are in office way too long. I mean, look at Illinois. Michael Madigan's been in long enough for two of my lifetimes, when you really think about it. That's unbelievable when you think about it. And the second of which is that politicians have too much power because government is too big. And that's the – we wouldn't right. be talking about this if politicians weren't able to grow government at the rate.
So the dirty little secret in Washington is that most of the time the people that you sent to D.C. don't have real power. So the real power in Washington, D.C. is concentrated among the House and Senate leadership, you know, in the White House and in the staff.
The
so
senior
the
staff.
The senior staff. So the average congressman.
Same way in Springfield and every state.
Exactly.
There are polls after poll that have – if you poll the average American, they say, I would love to just scrap them all. Send everybody new. Everybody kick everybody out and put all new people in.
And they miss how the system works. Because if they were all gone and you had term limits and you had the kind of turnover that you would create with that, the power becomes more concentrated in the unelected people in those institutions.
Every 2 years, the American people have an opportunity to dramatically change politics. They've chosen not to dramatically change politics. That's the way the Founding Fathers wanted it. And I'm not likely that it's going to happen, at least in my lifetime. On that note, I want to thank our left of center guests, our progressives, Georgia Logothetis from The Daily Cause, and Philip Beverly from Chicago State University. Thank you very much for being with us. And on the right side tonight, Stephanie Hitt, we thank you very much for joining us. And Charlie Kirk, Executive Director and Founder of Turning Point USA. That's our broadcast for this evening. This is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and Todd Nebel for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.